I'm with State Representative Scott Hochberg today. Scott represents the 137th House District out in Southwest Houston. Scott, you are one of the, I guess, the lead people for the Democrats on issues related to education. So let's start off by saying, what is your assessment of the special sessions that took place where, you know, the new tax bills were passed?
Well, essentially, school finance got pushed off the table in favor of property tax relief. The tax bill that was passed under by the governor and the current state leadership, all of the new taxes that were passed, the new business tax, the new increases in tobacco tax, the new used car tax, all of that money goes directly to property tax reduction. Not a penny of that, by law, not a penny of that can go to funding the schools. So while we shifted taxes around, we did nothing to put the schools in a better position to finance their operations in the coming years. And that means that the school districts, if they want more money, are going to be right back where they were in the first place, which is raising your local property taxes to get it. And I don't think that's what we went down there to do. It was part of the picture, but not the whole picture. When Mr. Sharp went around the state talking about his plan, he talked about the growth in these new taxes, the natural growth in these new taxes from growth in the economy, being able to be used for increased funding to the schools and other state needs. When we got to the session, it was a bait and switch, and the first thing that happened is that they rolled out a bill that prohibited any of the new money from the new taxes from going to anything other than property tax reduction. Then they committed to property tax reduction that was about twice the size of what the new taxes are supposed to bring in. So not only did we not put the schools in a better position to fund their operations and growth in the future, we put the state budget in as much as a $5 billion a year deficit, which is huge to overcome, even if you're wildly optimistic about the revenue from the new business tax.
Now, I believe State Senator Steve Ogden has recently said that he feels pretty good about this coming biennium in terms of revenue.
We came into the biennium with something like $5 or $6 billion minimum in the bank, partly because we did very minimal increases in education 2 years back, because we got some additional federal money, because the economy's been blown and going because of the high cost of gas and oil prices, but there was no indication that you're going to build up that sort of revenue in the years in the future. So we may be able to get by this first biennium without things looking too bad. But we have absolutely no idea what the new business tax is going to bring in. We have estimates. And if those come up short rather than long, we're going to be in a world of hurt.
Where do you think we need to go from this point in terms of, first of all, ensuring that the business tax grows with the state's population needs and educational needs, and two, dedicating some of that money to education?
Yeah, I think that the property tax reduction is overpromised. I don't think we can meet what the governor passed and what he's campaigning on with the revenues that are coming in. And so I think that's going to have to be adjusted to the actual revenue. You know, what a lot of folks don't realize is when you say you're going to get a tax cut, they think all you do is you cut your tax rate. And if you were a city or even the state with its sales tax, that would be true. But what the state has done here is they're not giving you a property tax cut. They're ordering school districts to give you a property tax cut. And with that comes the promise that whatever the districts lose because of that mandatory tax cut, the state will make up. That means the state has to have real money to give to the school districts. It's not just, well, we won't do this, this, or that. It's, we've got to write a check to the school districts for what we're ordering them not to levy on local taxpayers. And there is clearly not the money in the bank now, nor do the estimates from the leadership on what the business taxes will raise added to that to give you the amount of money you've got to pay the school districts for what they're losing. So I think that promise is not going to be kept. If it is kept, the only way to keep it would be through huge increases in state fees, in the sales tax, which is something that's been already put on the table. is that we're going to essentially reduce the property tax by increasing the sales tax. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so something's going to have to give somewhere.
Well, you talk about the sales tax. That was the original plan in the previous session.
I lose track
of whether it was regular or special at this point, because there's been so darn many of them.
Absolutely was.
And that was ultimately defeated by a coalition of Republicans that joined in with the Democrats, the so-called Hochberg 14, that,
Actually, the tax plan that was laid out was not defeated by the so-called Hochberg 14, but by an overwhelming vote of the House, Republicans and Democrats. But that plan was built to fail. There was not buy-off by the business community on the plan at the time, and the leadership wasn't going to do something the business community didn't buy off on. And we didn't have the court ruling, and the underlying sort of backdrop that everybody knew throughout those sessions were that at least the speaker didn't want to pass a plan until he knew exactly what the court was going to order him to do. This was not about what's the best thing to do for the schools. This was about what is the court going to force us to do for the schools. And so when they came back and retrenched and reworked the business tax, it was always John Sharp's contention that if you wanted more money for the schools immediately, you were going to have to pass a sales tax increase in addition to the business tax. It wasn't put on the agenda, I think, because there was an election coming up. But nobody has argued that Sharp is wrong. And frankly, there are a lot of Republican members who will tell you privately, if they don't tell you publicly, that they believe in a sales tax increase. I mean, if you remember when Mr. Heflin was in the legislature, his whole goal was to turn all of the taxes into sales tax. Now, the truth is that a sales tax, if you're not in the upper income brackets, a sales tax hurts you more than a property tax does. You just don't see it as much,
right?
And because you're not getting that one tax bill at the end of the year. But if you look at what you pay in sales taxes, particularly if you make a major purchase, a car, major appliances, increasing the sales tax when we already have one of the highest sales taxes in the country doesn't make a lot of sense to me, and I think would be particularly damaging to merchants operating within this state. As you know, we were already under competition with the internet, and until the Congress in Washington were to change anything with regard to taxing across state lines, as long as it's free, as long as you're tax free across state lines, every time you increase sales taxes within your state, you're hurting your local merchants.
Now, there's another side of all this, which is the spending side. The Center for CPPP has argued that one of the effects of the budget that was passed in the special session is that it's going to force spending cuts because of, I'm trying to remember the exact language.
If you're $5 billion in the hole per year, you got to come up with it somewhere. And $5 billion you're talking about on a budget of... on the state side of the budget, and not if you exclude the money you get from the feds that is a pass-through and you don't have a lot of control over. The state side of the budget is in the realm of $35 billion. So $5 billion is a lot, and then half of that 30 or 35 already is going to education. So you're looking at taking the rest out of what's left. And for instance, $5 billion is the entire cost of the state prison system, DPS, all of the public safety expenditures that the state of Texas makes, and then throw in a whole bunch of the regulatory agencies. So to catch up with that through budget cuts, you have to do some really drastic things. And so that's why I think the property tax promise doesn't get fulfilled, because I don't know that anybody is willing to shut the prison system down, for instance, I suppose there are people who would be willing to take us out of Medicaid and to close down CHIP. You hear those sorts of whispers in the halls of the Capitol. But I think that would be a disaster for the state and disaster for the people of the state, and I don't think that's going to realistically happen. But you sure might have pressures to do the same sorts of things we did a few years ago, where we pulled a bunch of people all out of the Children's Health Insurance Program, gave up the federal match on top of it that we get, which is about 2.5 to 1. You know, it's my bottom line on the special session in that regard is that it's not nearly so hard to pass something if you don't have to make the books balance. And the position they were in, since they were working with the budget, the prospective, the budget for 2 years from now rather than the budget we were immediately in, is that they didn't have to make the books balance. So nobody had to explain where you were going to get the money. And you stand on the floor and raise those questions, and people will say that's for the next legislature to figure out.
Yeah, it's always for the next legislature to figure out.
One thing else that I don't want to get past while we're talking about the special session is that the money that was given out to the school districts out of that surplus that's in the current budget was given out, every different piece of it was given out in a way that gave those districts that already have the most advantages more of an advantage. If you look at, for instance, the small allotment that everybody's talking about that was provided for high schools, it was based on the number of kids you have in high school. The larger number of kids you have that are dropping out, the less money you're going to get out of this deal. And so if you line up all the school districts around the state, you find out that for that high school allotment, Houston comes in amongst the 10 lowest districts out of 1,042 in the state in terms of what impact that will have here. The schools on the top end who get the most, Highland Park, the wealthy area in Dallas, Eanes, very wealthy area in Austin, Alamo Heights, places where kids come to school knowing that they're going to get through high school. And this is part of sort of a general plan. We have had a philosophy in this state that says you put the resources where they're most needed. The resources follow the kids based on the essentially the difficulty level of bringing that child up to grade level with everybody else. The less education you have at home, the harder that is to do. The lower income it is at home in general, the harder that is to do. If a child doesn't have good knowledge of English coming into the school, tremendous challenge to get them to the point where you can then teach them in English and teach them what they have to do. All of that costs. All of that's additional time on task. All of that is extra tutors, extra help after school, summer programs. And we have always recognized, not nearly enough, but we've always had a recognition of that in the funding formulas. This year we went the opposite direction. We had to fight to maintain the relatively small extra compensation for children in poverty. And we got it back to even, but no further. In the meantime, we gave extra money based on the percentage of your kids that go through high school, which is a strange way to come up with a plan. We did new school funding that tremendously advantages the richest districts in the state, just in terms of formula funding, at the detriment of all the others. And that's not good for, that doesn't make sense from a fiscal standpoint, because you're spending a lot of money and yet you're not fixing the problems that you set out to fix because you haven't put any additional resources there. Does that make any sense?
It does. Now, talking about spending a lot of money, there are people who complain that we already spend a ton of money on education. We don't really have very good results to show for it. Why can't we do better with what we've got before we put more money into it? How do you address that?
Well, I people say to me, do schools waste money and do they need more money? And I say the answer is yes in both cases. Come over with me to Lee High School, where they have 42 native languages, where you've got a principal who works his heart out, where you've got a dedicated core of teachers, and where they do achieve remarkable results, and tell me they have enough resources when I know they need more security, when I know they need more language help, when I know they need better science facilities, where the physical facility is adequate but is certainly no Taj Mahal, where they've got a whole bunch of portable buildings out back. they're doing a great job with what they've got. Could they do a better job with more? Absolutely. I think it's absolutely fair and appropriate to ask more fiscal responsibility of school districts. One of the things that I sort of slipped into House Bill 1 during the special session was some changes in the way internal auditors of school districts must report to school board members. I've had conflict of interest provisions. I've proposed statewide real-time accounting system, number one, so that school districts aren't spending a lot of money changing their accounting system every time we decide we want more information at the state level, but secondly, so that we can provide an early warning system for things that are going out of control. The leadership has been reluctant to do these things because when you talk about fiscal accountability, they sort of jump on the mantra of local control, and it's none of our business, and so their philosophy is, let's just continue to put more financial information out on the basis that taxpayers are going to sit around at home and analyze their school board's budget and come into the school board meeting and make them make changes. Well, I'm glad that there are a few people around the state who do that, but for the vast majority of us, I mean, Walmart doesn't ask their customers to analyze the efficiency of Walmart. Walmart sees as their job being the most efficient supplier of those goods as they can. And we at the state level ought to see that as our job rather than just saying, okay, we're going to dump a bunch of stats on you. And if y'all want more efficient schools, y'all go out and do it yourself. Ross Perot came to testify at one of our hearings. And we were talking about financial accountability. And I said, Mr. Perot, you know, you run big companies. What would you do? How would you change it? And he said, well, and he proceeded to tell me about, in their companies, they always had very close to real-time review of what was going on financially within their different groups. And when something got out of whack, they had somebody who was knowledgeable who could sit there and say, all right, please tell us why. You know, an example I heard the other night. Please tell us why at one of the high schools in Houston that's failing, please tell us why there's $1 million that's been allocated to you that you haven't spent. We have nobody to ask those questions until the livestock is already out of the barn, and I think we should be much more aggressive about that.
Tell me more about this, about the whole closing of schools. There's a lot of uproar in Houston about it now. I mean, the idea is that...
Charles, can you imagine, or do you know, you don't have to imagine, the uproar that rural Texas raises if you even suggest that any of their schools be closed? Because they know, in rural Texas, that the school is the economic center and essentially the community center of their communities. It is no different in neighborhoods in Houston. And I'm not sure what you accomplish by closing the school, because you still got the kids to educate. And now you got to move them around.
Where they'll most likely be going farther away from home.
I mean, can you, and yet we bang on people and say we want neighborhood schools, we want parental involvement, and we want a sense of community. And then the first thing when we talk about when there's a problem is, well, let's just close the school. How about making the school work? How about putting the resources on it? Whose responsibility is it that school work in the first place? It's the school boards through their superintendent. And yet, I've not heard any proposal that if a school doesn't work, we close the school board. I think here again is a place where the state has a responsibility to do more than just have quick answers. You know, if the state knows how to run that school better, we should be prepared to send in, if it's a financial issue, teams to help figure out what the problem is, not in a confrontational way, but unless we have to. But and if it's an educational issue, if we've got folks that know how to do it, we ought to be able to send people in there to do it. We have for years talked about incentives for teaching in difficult schools. and yet we've really been reluctant to either impose those or provide the money to do it. We're starting to get into some of that, but only through this drive to base teacher pay on test scores. And again, I think that's the backwards way to come at it. The best teachers I had were the ones that inspired me to do more. That, you know, I'm in the computer business today, probably a lot because I had a wonderful teacher in high school who went out of his way to let me play with the school's one computer that they owned and let me do it on my study hall time, and I wasn't even in his class anymore, and no way that my name was going to show up on his test score rank. And he probably had pretty good test scores of his kids, depending on what kids he had, but the thing that set him apart was that he was willing to go out and look for the kids that needed something extra, either on the high end of the scale or the low end of the scale, and make sure they got it. And that's all real hard to measure with a standard rubric that you can apply to, say, all the teachers in HISD. But to me, it would make more sense to go find those folks and to figure out what it would take to get them to come over even for a year or 2 years into a Wheatley. You know, Representative Dutton talked about, I'm not sure which school, so I don't want to say, but it was one of the high schools in his district that had terrible math scores. And he went and said, I want to talk to the math specialist. Well, it turned out, according to Mr. Dutton, that not only was there no certified teacher in math at the high school, there was no certified teacher in math anywhere in the feeder pattern. And, you know, we have bad math scores in high school. You don't need to close the school to do that. Incentives based on test scores aren't going to fix that either. But raising that point and actually looking for, as Mr. Dutton did, why do we have a problem here, can make a heck of a lot of difference.
Let's talk about test scores for just a second. Okay. I mean, there's some...
You're going to leave me some time to talk about things other than education?
Well, you know, you're a pretty good source of information on that.
Okay.
Just briefly, how would you use standardized tests like the TACS to achieve the goal of...
Better education?
Better education.
Yeah, so it's a great question because, you know, the TACS is an accountability system, but there's never been an accountability study done of the TACS. In other words, all we know is that we're getting better test scores on the TACS test. We can teach to the test, and we can do a darn good job of it. But we don't know, other than anecdotally, what that's doing for the overall educational level of the kids in Texas. There's a couple of things that I'd do, and I've proposed legislation on this, and for the first time a few months ago, I've actually had people who have been advocates for TOS as it is starting to say to me, you know, Huckberg, this may make sense. One of the problems with TOS is that it is a single level test. And so we have this fight over where do you set the level? How tough should the test be? If you set it at, set the high school exit test, for instance, at the minimum level for college, for being able to do college work, there's a whole lot of kids who don't plan to go to college, and should they be denied a high school degree because they're not college prep kids? If you set it low, then the colleges complain that you haven't, that a kid with a high school diploma isn't necessarily ready to do college work. A test like SAT or ACT is not a single level test. The questions are of multiple difficulty, and what they're trying to determine is where does the child place. I have argued that we should have a set of single level questions that we use as the minimum indicator as to whether the child's ready for graduation or movement to the next grade, but that we should also have a variety of higher level questions on it. And in order to provide some incentive for districts and schools and teachers to do more than teach to that single level of the pole vault. I mean, I compare it to a pole vault competition where they never move the pole. They never move the bar, rather. And you keep jumping over the bar at the same level, and if you can jump over it 50 times at the same level, you win. We'd never have a sport like that. you always want to move every child as far up the bar as they can, but there's no incentive to that right now in the current system. The second thing I would do is I would set up a study to figure out how to design a test that is the least likely to be gamed. And there are different ways to do that. A few years ago, I got TEA to agree that they were going to, quote, put more non-multiple choice questions on the test. They upheld their end of the bargain by putting one open answered question. They said, well, it's more than what we had, which was zero. We all know that tox test preparation has a lot of elements of, well, here's how you read this paragraph so that you can answer the questions below it, or here's how you make educated guesses of the multiple choice test. That has no place in this business because it doesn't give us good results and it doesn't encourage learning. And as a leader in one of the first states to do testing, we ought to have the best test, and we're not going in that direction at all. There's also one other issue that's coming down from the feds that I think is very serious and has come to light recently. There are some number of kids in this state, in any state, who because of learning disabilities are never going to be on grade level at their normal, at their age. We have dealt with that in Texas by having a test called the SDAA. I don't remember what it stands for, but I passed the legislation years ago. And the purpose of that was to say, we're not going to exempt these kids, but we're going to have a test that we can match to their individual education plan and get some accountability in these special ed programs, allow the child to participate in an accountability system, do something that will give some information to the teachers on what they need to learn. The folks at the Federal Department of Education don't like that test, and they have a new requirement, and the new requirement is that within a short amount of time, 97% of your kids are going to have to be on grade level taking the standard tox test. And where that really breaks down, even if you agree that you could get to 97% across the whole population, is that a lot of our schools, we cluster special needs kids in order to give them the best resources rather than having it spread out amongst five or six schools. That is going to be impossible in those schools to have them meet the federal requirements for participation and average yearly progress. Those schools are going to be considered failures, despite the fact that they may be doing a great job with their kids. And we have argued and argued and argued this point. Commissioner Neely has argued this point at the federal government and has gotten nowhere on it. I think a testing system that's designed to get you a number, whether that number is valid or not, is a bad idea. And that has always been my concern with tox, and I think the federal legislation is making that worse instead of better.
All right. Well, let us talk about another issue, crime. A lot of concern about it this year in particular. What are you hearing from your constituents, and what, if anything, do you think the legislature needs to do to address some of these concerns next year?
Well, crime is nothing new to those of us in Southwest Houston. It's nice to see City Hall kind of wake up to the issue. The crime was increasing out here, and even violent crime was increasing out here long before Katrina. And I started talking about it based on the stats a few years ago. We have a gang issue in this city, and that needs to be addressed. And you're right in what you imply that most of this is not a state issue, but there are some specific things that I think we can do at the state level. I filed legislation in the spring and hope to bring it back that will help schools deal with gangs in their schools and deal specifically with some what I would call glitches in the law that makes it hard for a principal to remove the gang element from his or her school. There are some criminal code issues also. For instance, one of the gang initiation rights is something called a jump in, where basically you have to volunteer to let the gang beat the you-know-what out of you in order to prove that you can take it. gang members participating in a jump-in cannot be prosecuted under our assault laws because the victim has volunteered.
Volunteered, sure.
And interestingly enough, there is an exception to that defense, and it's for fraternity and sorority hazing. This is sort of fraternity and sorority hazing taken to a whole nother level, and we need to fix that issue. And I'm going to try to work with the DA's Association and with the Defense Attorneys Association. It's also an issue in the schools because that kind of an assault is not a violation of law, and it makes it difficult for them to take the kinds of action that they need to do. The second piece that I've been working on for several years now is that the state does have a responsibility to make sure that local law enforcement has accurate, up-to-date information about gang membership and gang activities. We have a statewide gang database system. Unfortunately, the last time I checked, the largest jurisdiction that participates in it is Corpus Christi. And with respect to whatever gang problem they have in Corpus Christi, that's not Houston. If you don't have Houston and Dallas and Fort Bend County and Harris County participating in the system, you don't have a system. A lot of that had to do with the way DPS established the system. And so I've been working directly with DPS to make that into a robust tool that our officers can actually use. And my involvement has brought about a series of meetings between DPS and some of the major police departments and specific gang officers that aren't currently using the information or participating in putting the information in order to get them to tell DPS how to make the system work for them. And I am hopeful but never confident that we will see some results of that beginning of next year and actually see a redesign of the system so that the officer on the street can find out about gang activity both within their area and across jurisdictional lines. It doesn't make sense for an HPD officer not to be able to identify an identified gang member from Harris County who's not within HPD. So those are two things off the top that I'm working on.
Okay. Immigration. Governor's talking about border security. It's another issue that's coming up in this year's election. What do you think, if anything, the state legislature should be doing about this issue?
I think the state legislature should be asking the federal government to deal with the issue of border security and should be demanding that. The border states are in no position to defend the border, and that's not our job. We're unfortunately barely in position to do the things that our own guard needs to be doing and have available because so many of our reserves and National Guard members are overseas. But no matter, the state of Texas is not in the financial position nor will be to solve the border security problem.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about your campaign. What have you been doing? You are in kind of a unique district in that most of the people in your district are apartment dwellers. So there's a lot of people who don't live at the same address very long. How do you campaign in a district like that? How do you stay on top of it?
Well, it's the hardest thing about staying on top of and campaigning in an apartment district is that apartments generally don't have civic associations. And, you know, it's pretty easy to stay on top of what's of concern in an area with a strong civic association because you go to the civic association meetings, you stay in touch with their leadership, and you get pretty good feedback. Apartments, you've got to reach out to those apartment owners that are actually involved in their properties. There are some good ones, and there are some that are not so good. And so I try to do that. I try to stay involved in community organizations that serve the people in apartments, stay in touch with religious leaders. In terms of campaigning in apartment areas, the first challenge is to get people registered. And so we do as aggressive a registration campaign as I've seen any kind of a campaign do. We go door to door in apartments and register people. We work with apartment owners and management to set up registration tables at various times. And we do about a dozen other things, everything from direct mail to working with merchants to get people registered so that when Election Day comes around, they're voting, they are near the place where they're supposed to vote, and they're voting where they are supposed to vote. Not getting re-registered when you move is not something that is unique to apartment residents. It's not the first thing people think of. It's gotten better with motor voter, which means when you go change your driver's license, you are asked if you also need to change your voter registration, and you're given the form. And I've found that has made a difference. An awful lot of people who used to just never get around to changing their voter registration now do it when they change their driver's license. But there's a lot of education involved, and we devote a tremendous amount of effort to it. And then we work hard to turn those people out. There has been an attitude amongst some elected officials and candidates in this area that you don't pay attention to low turnout areas. I don't believe that. I believe it's in the best interest of an area like Golfton that's traditionally low turnout to do what they can to increase their turnout because unfortunately it's not just the squeaky wheel that gets the grease, it's the voting area that gets the grease. And I think community leaders in and around the Golfton area have started to get that the way they can increase the influence they have toward the allocation of city services is to show up at the voting booth. Almost doesn't matter who they vote for, just the mere fact that they turn out will get them more attention. So apartments are part of the campaign. Homeowner areas are part of it also, and really most of the issues cross those boundaries. Crime is an issue in neighborhoods. Crime is certainly an issue in apartments and in apartment communities. This is the densest district in the state, and maybe they have the densest representative. I'm not sure. this is there are more people in a smaller amount of space, and that in itself brings about a tremendous number of issues, not only related to crime but also related to transportation. And we've been able to start making some improvements to transportation out here using funds raised through the tax reinvestment zone and the management district. With the city so short on funds for infrastructure improvement, or at least with the demand so high, it's vital that we have a little pocket of money that we can use in this area with the participation of local businesses and homeowners associations to get important projects done. And we're finally doing some work on Bel Air Boulevard, which is a traffic nightmare if you've ever been out there, not just in rush hour, but on a typical Saturday afternoon. And Harwin, right here where my office is frankly dangerous from a traffic standpoint because we haven't made the improvements that we need to in terms of turnout lanes and controlling where access is from shopping areas and the sorts of things that get a lot of attention on a road like Westheimer that's high profile but slip through the cracks when it comes to a Harwin or a Bel Air because you don't have a Galleria Association or a West Chase Association advocating them. I've worked real hard to try to strengthen the economic development districts out here because they do provide that voice on an ongoing basis, and there is nobody else that can do it.
All right. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Not that I can think of. This is an area of tremendous challenge. We've got some good things going on in this area. Neighborhood Centers has made a commitment to build a large a facility out here. There's economic growth all along the Bel Air corridor, and my goodness, if you're looking for an affordable home inside the Beltway, that's fairly quick to downtown now that 59 has now that the 59 construction has ended. You would be surprised at the kind of housing you can buy out here for pretty moderate prices by city standards. So I invite people to come and get to know Sharpstown and get to know the restaurants we have here and the facilities we have here. And it's a lot of people don't know that this is in their backyards.
Scott Hochberg, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Charles.